Content in this episode may contain information and discussions of grief and trauma, childbirth, sexual assault, racial discrimination, pregnancy, violence, or mental health and more, which some listeners could find triggering. This podcast is not intended for young listeners, so please listen responsibly. If you find yourself being triggered or affected by the content of this podcast, please reach out to a mental health professional in your area or call a national hotline for support. Welcome to the Twisted Sisterhood Podcast, hosted by Ashley Mitchell and Kelsey Vandervliet Ranyard, a podcast by birth moms for birth moms to give a platform to a silenced voice in the triad. You can find us on Instagram at Twisted Sisterhood Podcast, on Facebook at Twisted Sisterhood, and Twitter at Birth Mom Podcast. Give us a follow and use our hashtag, There Goes the Sisterhood. And if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair.
Welcome back to the Twisted Sisterhood Podcast. I am your co-host, Kelsey Vandervliet Ranyard, joined by my other co-host, Ashley Mitchell.
Hello! And
we are excited about today's episode. We have a good friend of ours that agreed to come on to this absolute shit show. Her name is Erica Gonzalez. She is a birth mom. She's 29. Feeling fine from California, and she's a little over 4 years post-placement with an open adoption. She's here to be an ally for fellow birth moms and help normalize healthy, close relationships between birth parents and adoptive parents. Welcome, Erica.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yay!
Yeah, we're so excited.
Really grateful that you guys asked me to do this.
Oh, for sure. And this has kind of been in the works for a while. I've been like, okay, I need to ask Erica, and then I would ask her, and then we would, it's like hurry up and wait type of thing. And so now we finally have a moment to do this, and it's going to be great. So why don't you just tell us about yourself, your adoption, as much as you would wish to say. Go for it.
Well, like Kelsey said, my adoption is open and we're about 4 years deep into it. And I have always really had a pretty healthy relationship with my son's parents. And I don't take that for granted at all. But I think that when I was first starting to communicate with other birth moms and seek support, I kind of realized that I was an outlier, and it has really opened my eyes to kind of the normal adoption triad dynamic that doesn't really work as well as mine does, as harsh as that sounds. But I definitely don't think that it's that hard to do either. So my concern for other birth moms and adoptive parents and adopted children is that they're not in the long game the way that you would hope. And that's a disservice to everybody that is involved. So
it's interesting because when I met you years ago now, I remember I was pretty gung-ho anyways. But I was like, yeah, you should do this with us. You should go here with us. And you should go to support group with us. And Erica's always been like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, wait a second. And then even just in the little like online community, I feel like you've always kind of said to me, you know, I just don't really feel in the club, is I think what you would say.
Yeah.
So sure. Elaborate on that, like how you don't feel a part of the club.
Well, I think I started to reach out to birth moms about a year into my post-placement. And Kelsey and Ashley were definitely the first ones to reach back out and connect with me and make me feel welcome. But as I started to be comfortable sort of sharing my story a little bit and going to like the group meetings and all of those support resources that are out there, it was really hard for me to feel like I fit in, because there were a lot of stories where birth moms were not, you know, in regret of placement, but like in turmoil over their relationship post-placement, and the fact that it wasn't what they thought it would be. And they, you know, thought that they could have higher expectation, or, you know, they thought that it was going to be something that would develop healthily, and just wasn't happening. And so when I'm sitting there in a group and, you know, someone is like, I can't get a hold of them, and this is an open adoption, and I don't know what to do, or I don't even know how to talk to them, or I don't even know how to ask them for pictures. And it was kind of like, I was shocked. I didn't know how I could relate to that at all. And then it really developed in a shame for me at first, because I thought I was supposed to be more of a wreck and more upset and more angry. And so I tried to manufacture those emotions for myself, and it was inauthentic. And then I kind of realized that what I have is healthy and safe, and I don't see that much elsewhere in other triads. And, you know, I think for me, it was easy, because when I matched with the first family that I had chosen, I kind of let them know what the situation was with my son's birth father and his family, and that they might contest it, and that they kind of had a little bit of influence in that community, so it could be kind of a challenging road ahead, and that I had no choice but to make that happen and to, you know, do the, you know, just follow through with adoption regardless of that situation. And that family, you know, took a few days and let me know that they didn't want to follow through because they didn't think that they could handle the financial burden of a contested adoption and just all of the dramatics, which is totally understandable. But then my agency reached out to other professionals in adoption, and they found other families, and I was about 8.5 months pregnant. So I was just devastated. I just felt like I had no idea what the adoption world was like. So I didn't realize that it was okay to keep going and keep searching, and that there were families out there. Because I, like I said, I had no clue what adoption was like. And I matched with my son's adoptive parents, and I grew really close with them really fast, because we just jumped right in, and I told them everything that was going on. I told them about my son's birth family and what that would all be like. And they responded just so graciously to all of the chaos that had ensued because of myself and the circumstances throughout my pregnancy, and really sort of loved me as a human being outside of their potential child's birth parent. So that definitely happened really quickly. And then once I had my son, that was really a kind of a bonding experience too, because it was not all smooth sailing with my son's birth father. And so definitely that time of having to be honest with them about everything and just have them have real genuine compassion for me and sort of allyship, because at the time I had no familial support and I had really isolated myself because I just didn't want to explain anything to any of my friends. So I just kind of fell off the map, and they really sort of enveloped me in the love and support that I needed. And I think that, you know, 4 years on, it is still that way. And I still rely on them in that sense that I know that they're always going to be there. And I know that they are always very present for me. And I mean, when I was pregnant and I literally was like, I'm going to have to move away. And I'm going to have to like never see anyone that I ever knew before after this. And I'm just going to like move somewhere far away and just never tell anybody about this ever again. And, you know, just some, I thought I was going to have to live some kind of like movie or something. And then the counselor that I was entitled to see, I think it was 3 sessions at the time in California, was what an expectant mother or birth mother was entitled to have sessions with. And she really, that was a really huge resource in my healing for me, was that therapist. And my son's adoptive parents saw that. And so they were like, go to therapy, go to her as much as you need. If you need to go to her 2 times a week, like, we don't care. We got it. Like, they just really didn't want me to feel that shame that was sort of just chronically in my brain to make me like want to leave and never come back. And they were very like, no, we want you around. Like, you're his birth mother. Like, we want you a part of his life. We love you. And we have that bond that is kind of outside. It's independent of our son, you know? So we have a friendship, and I feel like they are 2 of my biggest allies and mentors. And when I accomplish something, they, you know, like, know what day it's on, and they are always cheering me on. And they, I mean, if I like need a recommendation letter or anything, they've got me. And it's just this dynamic that I am always grateful for, but I always am saddened that it's not the standard. And I understand how that happened. I understand that makes sense, but at the same time, it's not safe for anyone to sort of like take the humanity and the humanness out of birth mothers and people that place their children. And, you know, I just think that it's sort of something we need to talk about.
Erica, I'm so glad that you're here, because I've been wanting to talk about this. You know, it's complicated. I have a couple of notes, and I want to go back and pull out a couple of things that you said just to kind of recap. And thank you so much for sharing your story. You know, I'm 15 years post-placement, and my son and I, when you pull out just me and my adoption situation and me, because I'm on a platform of advocacy. And so we talk about a lot of stuff that isn't directly affected by my relationship, because I was so excited that you were, because I'm like, when I get to just be Ashley and talk about Derek and talk about my kids and talk about our open adoption relationship, I feel the same way. I'm so grateful. And I had a conversation the other day. I was like, how lucky is that? Because we know that's not the norm, that it was just lucky that I found out of a stack of strangers, this family that just got it. It was the most natural thing in the world for them to embrace me, accept me, support me through all of it. And to now have a 15-year-old that comes and sleeps over, you know, people look at my relationship, they're like, what? That is crazy that he sleeps over. But we have a lot that we unpack, and because my husband and I have other kids and, you know, there's a lot to it, but it's the most normal thing in the world for him to want to come and stay over. Like it's a non-issue. And, one of the things that I really loved when you were talking about, you know, we want to validate all lived experiences because it matters and every birth mom is going to come to the table. What's really frustrating for me, before we got into real heavy advocacy and education, I rarely even get to just talk about like my own lived experience anymore because it's so much on law reform and ethics and adoption. And so I don't get to just sit and celebrate our open adoption. But I remember when we were maybe six years out, I would post stuff and I would have birth moms and adoptees come at me all the time. Oh, just wait. In 5 years, it's not going to be like that. And just wait. And I'm like, we're 15 years and doing sleepovers. And I think we, there's such a generational gap in people that came from close adoption that are still trying to like figure out this host group of like birth moms that have these open adoption relationships. But, one of the other things that I really, really love about Erica's story is she's not sitting here honoring her adoption in a way that's so naive and so ignorant to the hardship of what adoption looks like. It's not all fluffy and rainbows and this beautiful thing. She sat in the trenches through her pregnancy and had to strip bare very early on. And so it's not that she's coming to the table in a space of complete denial. It's just in its purest form. It's just in the way that it should be with relational long-term building. And we talk about that all the time. And so I love that you use the word like allyship, because when you watch the sides fight for each other and lift each other, I think it's really powerful. Not everybody's going to be best friends with each other. I mean, Lana and I don't talk hardly ever throughout the year, but there's not, I have no doubt in my mind how she feels about me and what she thinks about me. And when it's time to reach out and connect with each other, it's a non-issue. I can reach out today. I could text her right now and just be like, oh, I was just thinking about you, and it'd be a non-issue. But I love that you're coming to the table in a space that's like, hey, we've had to peel back to the most vulnerable space and we're still all in. And another thing is just like, it's just not really that complicated. Like when we aren't making about our own shit and our own insecurity and our own issues and fear and pressures that outside sources put on us, when you're just looking at the basic relational piece, is it really that complicated to grasp and understand the concept?
It's funny that you say that, because when she said like, it's not that complicated, I was kind of taken aback. Like, yes, it is though, because you have all these different people coming together, but like at its core, it's really not, because when you have people that fill in the gaps for one another, it really isn't that complicated. Right. It only gets complicated when one side or more of the triad starts taking the humanity out of the relationship, and then it gets complicated. But when you are filling in the gaps for each other and being allies to one another, it's not, because it's what it comes down to is valuing each other and striving for equity in your relationship.
Yeah. And the dignity in the relationship, mm-hmm. It's just in basic human relationship, it's not complicated, but I think it's easy to let the outside opinions and pressures and professionals and social media impact. Erica, you're not the first birth mom that I have talked to that said, is there something wrong about me because I'm not a hot mess about this? Like I really am and am okay about that. And I'm like, you are exactly where you're supposed to be. And if that's what your lived experience looks like, then it's okay to be all in with that. You don't have to be a mess and undone about it all the time. It's not, you're not the first one that has said that we've had message about.
And I think too that people's criticisms, I always try to like anticipate the criticism I'll get for saying something I say, but I would think that there would be criticism possibly on like, well, you know, you're at peace with it, but what if your adoptee is not? But I think the way Erica approaches it, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you approach it with a piece that's like a piece of what was and a piece of what will come. Am I right in guessing that?
For sure. I feel like the way that his parents treated me and the way that they very much so invested in my healing has allowed me to not feel sad when I look at them forming their own identity as a family, because I also feel included in that. And I don't feel like it is a loss for me in that way, where I look at pictures of them or I see them like going on vacation and, you know, having all of these memories and stuff. It's not, that doesn't make me sad in the way that I know it would if I had continued to live in my shame. And the sense of belonging that I have and the inclusion that I feel within that family unit has helped me to have that sense of peace. And I think that with my son specifically, I don't doubt at all that the way that they communicate adoption to him and in the years to come will not be loving and genuine and comforting. And so because I trust them in that, I don't wonder so much about how he'll feel about me, because I know that he sees that they love me outside of the adoption. Because I mean, we're friends. I mean, throughout all of quarantine in 2020, we sent each other the funniest memes just to like get through it. I can talk to them about everything and still have boundaries myself where I'm able to step back and form my own identity outside of adoption because I'm in that safe space. And so that's what is so valuable to the way that they've treated me, is that it's allowed me to heal in a way that has not been dangerous to myself, because I have that compassion from them specifically. So now it's like whatever to me what other people think about it, because they've honored me and continue to do so.
So I wanted to talk to just real quick about, well, not real quick, I think we wanted to spend time on this subject, but when we do say, okay, this isn't that complicated, you have to fill in the gaps for one another, you have to strive for equity in the relationship. What really makes that difficult is we are all on these different levels. When we approach this relationship. So we approach this in a natural, unequal dynamic. We have adoptive parents, which are a privileged party. We have birth parents, which is underprivileged party. And we have this adoptee who didn't have any choice in the matter. And we made all these decisions in hopes that this was the best interest for this child. So, we really are dealing with a very, like two very different set of classes. And what, so I want to unpack that. Like, I want to talk about classism and adoption, because we see this kind of all the time online where we have people that are acknowledging, I think just outright acknowledging that there are two different classes in their adoption. But they are outright also admitting that they are not doing anything to strive for equity in their relationship. And just as a preface, equity doesn't mean co-parenting in adoption, but it does mean valuing each other the same. Birth parents and adoptive parents and adoptees being able to be valued as human beings, equal human beings. So, yeah. So any thoughts on that from either of you?
Well, I think 2020 really highlighted the fact that everyone in this country is living in two different economies. And it's always been like that. And a lot of people are in agreement with that. But now we know that for a fact. That's not up for debate. And so what that does is it creates this world where it's normal that, you know, there's a mom at the grocery store right now as we speak, and she's like trying to figure out how many bananas she can afford, you know? And then there's someone on the other end that has no idea how much a banana costs. They would never even think about
that. How
much
does a banana cost? $10?
Exactly. So it obviously makes sense that since we live in that kind of world, that adoption would become some sort of solution to this socioeconomic despair that we live in, where people constantly are saying, if you can't afford to have kids, then do not have kids. You have no business having children. And that's kind of the standard message that we get. And so we're all either ashamed of feeling like we can't afford to have kids and we haven't put ourselves in a position to have children. And that if, you know, someone that can't afford to have kids becomes pregnant, it's devastating no matter how much they want to parent. And so I think that's kind of what has led to the adoption industry to become what it is. It's become, I mean, I haven't talked to every birth mom out there, but I know, I'm sure a lot have come to their decisions based on their socioeconomic status and lack of resources and lack of support. And so when you have that, there's going to be people that have the resources and have the support that will thankfully be able to raise children and other people's children. And so it's just sort of, you can't deny that this is a class issue in a huge way. And it doesn't matter how you feel about it and how you personalize it. It's a fact that we live in a world where children are going hungry, and that is violence. We live in violence, and adoption kind of perpetuates that by making money, so much money, off of people that can't afford to raise their own children. And so it's a little bit dangerous, honestly.
I agree with that 100%. And when you look at, you just look at the fundraising alone and what adoptive parents are able to pull in and the support systems and things like that, versus, you know, women in crisis in these situations. But on top of not just economic class, but when you look at emotional power struggle in adoption as well, you have to talk about the emotional shift in power that shifts to the upper class, because what'll happen in a power shift, and if you can't, you know, everyone talks about we're all equal in this, and Kelsey has posted stuff about the pieces of the pizza and stuff about what's not equal and who's coming to the table. But on top of the economic issues and the resource issues and the systemic issues, you're looking at the power struggle emotionally that absolutely abuses and takes advantage of these women. And what'll happen is when the pregnant mothers come to the table and are supposed to be empowered with all of her rights as pregnant women, as soon as professionals are able to come in and manipulate that and to start to chip away that power, and as soon as relinquishment takes place, there's a power shift, and it's all based on ownership over a child. It's all around entitlement of motherhood and titles, and it's a class issue 100%. So you have women that come to the table with power in their choice and their right to choose with what happens with their child. As a mother, as they're considering their options, but as that starts to be stripped away, you get closer and closer and closer to relinquishment. Relinquishment takes place. There's a power shift. Now the adoptive parents, who are the privileged voice, now have not only all of the economic power, but they also have all the emotional power over the child. And if we're not in a space where in maybe like our open adoption situations, where when the adoptee comes to age to have an opinion, where there should be another power shift given to the adoptee, then we will never come full circle in regaining dignity in the individuals, because it should go from birth parent to adoptive parent back to adoptee full circle. And if we don't have empowerment in these open adoption relationships to begin with, it'll never come back to the adoptee, which is where it should have started to begin with, and always was based on ownership over a child in 100% based on fear. This is high risk financially. And how do we lock this in so that we can have control over everything that we've saved for, purchased, wanted for?
It's interesting. Like, when you post about, when anybody posts about, anything touching a criticism of the classism in adoption, I think that's when you get the most uncomfortable people, like, who really question it. And it's just kind of like so obvious to us that I'm like, what alternate universe are you living in? Because it's so obvious to the people that are on the lower side of the dynamic. But the people on the top, I think they, and we talk about too, like the notion of saviorism and stuff coming from the adoptive parents, but, and everyone's like, you know, don't be a white savior. Don't think that you're saving this child. But the fact is that the way that adoption is set up, that's the notion. And so to fight against that actively has to be continuous, constant. And that's part of, you know, striving for equity in your relationship. But like, it, classism is something that you have to actively, continuously, day after day, fight against in your relationship, in your open adoption relationship. Because you have to, as the privileged part of the triad, keep pulling the rope up and keep throwing it down for them to get it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, I understand how it can be when you have the resources to just make anything happen. And I don't mean to be arrogant or ignorant or anything. And I aspire to be someone that can just make things happen for myself, regardless of the cost, because it's something that I want for my life. But at the same time, you have to have the perspective that there are millions and millions and millions of people that are about to be homeless, and millions of parents that don't ever see an out to living in poverty. And that is generational. And so if you have a birth mother that placed her child in an effort to get their child out of that generational poverty, then you need to address the fact that we have children living in poverty in the first place. And I think that when you are in a position to be able to take a step back and maybe ask yourself, how can I use my resources better to help those that don't have resources? That is humbling and can be very fruitful for yourself as well as your community. And I implore everyone all the time in my life and elsewhere to redistribute the wealth and to not be afraid of mutual aid and mutual support, and to not hesitate to not hoard all of your money, you know? So it's, I mean, I think about this constantly, and Kelsey and I discuss this stuff probably more than we talk about anything else.
I think so, I talk to Erica more than I talk to my husband some days.
So we know how we feel about all of this, and, you know, coming up with an eloquent way to communicate that is a little challenging, but we have to call them like we see them, and, you know, encourage people and empower people to think for your communities and to really sit with the idea that there are people that are really, really struggling. And it's not just right now. That's just the world that we live in. And we can't rely on our leadership to inspire us or to take care of people that need help. We have to take matters in our own hands. And sometimes that is going on Instagram and looking up a mutual aid account. And I mean, you can look up mutual aid on social media, and everybody needs help. People are asking for money for their medications and, you know, baby formula. And so I think that needs to be prioritized if you're going to put the effort into destigmatize the idea of this wealth gap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just circling back to what Erica just stated so perfectly, you know, you talk about, you know, and we've unpacked this and talked about this a lot, that, you know, people out there want to just be like, oh, don't make a permanent choice for a temporary crisis. And I'm like, which temporary crisis you want to talk about? Because this is literally might be the smallest fire. And when community and society just wants to look at this one pregnancy and this girl got pregnant, and we're ignoring all the underlying issues that are leading up to these pregnancies, we are missing it. And helping one woman in one pregnancy, and if we're refusing to acknowledge anything else about the issues and lack of resources and why she's coming to the table to begin with, we're not getting it. We're not listening to her. And when we continue in the classism in adoption, where you're looking at women that continue to repeat cycles, continue to have babies, continue to place, when we're looking at the systems that continue to allow us to have support or resources or finances or things like that, when we're in a complete mindset of survival, we're going to do this or we're not going to. I mean, when we get into these fight or flight 100% mode, but everyone wants to shame the birth mom for her choices. And but when you're looking at the classism in it and those that are enabling systems to continue, enabling patterns, and offer those resources, but then we continue to blame us and push us down for taking advantage of the resources that are available. There's so many gaps, but when you get into just, oh, don't place your baby because we can help you in this one pregnancy. Okay. But what about the 9 other things that are going on that need support? Because if you want me to be successful and you want me to parent, then I'm going to need more than just walking out of the hospital with my child. It's bigger than just this isolated pregnancy. And so I really love, Erica, you talk about, it's not just right this second in this little crisis right now. It's big picture. If you can't see the whole woman in all the resources, and you get into that, into pro-life and pro-choice, if you're not seeing the whole woman and the whole picture in her situation, and we just want to generalize effort, we're going to miss them all day. All day, we're going to miss it.
Yeah, I think that it's important to take note that a birth mother's first trauma is not placing her child, and poverty is trauma. And to have to consider all of your options when you have all of those traumatic experiences behind you, and entrust people, whether it's adoption professionals or adoptive parents or any other supportive resources out there, you're taking the risk because you have no choice. I mean, I always use the analogy that I was on a sinking ship and I had to get the baby off the sinking ship. And so that's that was then, right? Now I'm not on a sinking ship, but that's because I had that support and that love and that compassion, and that the fact that it's lasted so long and knows no bounds is the only reason why I'm not still on a sinking ship.
I also, that's such a good analogy. And I also think it's important when we look at this from an activism standpoint, birth moms are time after time not taken seriously. Because all that anybody can ever see when we talk is, well, you were on a sinking ship. I'm like, well, hey, motherfucker, you didn't throw me a ladder. So what am I supposed to do? Where was my lifeboat? So I think that, a lot of people see, and going back to what Erica said before, a lot of people are not in this for the long game. Well, society doesn't see this as a long game either. So when you say you're a birth mom, you're like establishing yourself almost in like a caste system, like very fixed. It goes beyond class. You are putting yourself in a very fixed part of society to be at the lower end of any kind of dynamic. And so I think from an activism standpoint, when you are speaking out from that caste, you have very limited privilege, and the privilege extends to more than just, you know, finances and stuff like that. Privilege extends to your credibility and who's going to listen to you. And so when we're stuck in this, just like a, we're the live lobsters at the grocery store, we're alive inside this box, and you're reading about me and where I came from, but you don't know anything about where I am right now. And no one stops to ask. They just drop me in a pot and boil me, and that's it. And there's nothing more you can do. And so I think, in speaking activism, it's tough to be taken seriously. It's tough. People can listen to an adoptive parent's story all day long, and they might have embellished everything from beginning to end on how the God chose them and did this. But then a journalist approaches us. Well, it's not really credible because I don't have any proof. But you just published a story about the privileged part of the triad that just told you that God himself reached down and chose them. So it's wild to me, the kind of places that being a birth mom can take you, and the kind of places that you'll never be allowed to go. Because we have class mobility, right? Like you can move up and move around and do better for yourself. And some of it's up to a lot of chance and luck, but and it's also hard work. But you know, at the end of the day, you have that kind of opportunity. But when you have a label attached to you, whether it's race or being a birth mom or anything else, whether it's a crime you committed 20 years ago, you are in a fixed part of society. And there will be things that you will never, ever, ever be taken seriously on. And so I think if you are sitting here listening to this and you're like, I am the privileged part of the triad, I am an adoptive parent, or I am a professional, and I do have power to throw somebody a lifeboat or a ladder or a life jacket or something in whatever analogy that you want to use, you have to be conscious of that. Take these voices seriously, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
You know, it's interesting too, because when you talk about my story specifically, you know, I advocate all the time on like understanding the underlying issues of women coming to the table and pregnant. And I may be one of like the 1% that came to the table in just a random unplanned pregnancy, because I had all of the support. I had family support. I had a job. I had insurance. I was 26. I was on a different level already coming to the table, where on paper, there's not one reason why I should have placed. I should have been the single. I should have had all of this stuff, all of my shit, and the drugs and the sex and the jail and the, all of that kind of stuff came after placement. And once I was in the box, then I couldn't get out. And then all of the things kept happening. And so it's really interesting to sit and advocate in a space where I didn't have the underlying issues. All of those underlying issues came after the trauma had taken place for me. And then it was undone. I can go back and unpack definitely some church trauma and divorce even before my pregnancy. So I think there's always stuff. But however, on this large scale of adoption, all my shit came after. And so you've got this space where you come to the table with pregnancy, and then you have the headspace of where you come after the pregnancy. And when Kelsey was talking about like class movement, I absolutely think we have the ability to move and change. But we also have the ability to change into an even shittier spot than we started, because I am a 100% representation of that. And that is 100% based on none of the resources that were available after. And that absolutely came from, now I'm a birth mom, now I have this label, and now none of these resources, now I'm viewed by society as a certain way, and none of these resources are available. And I shifted maybe even down worse, and have been climbing out since. I'm not in a space where I would say that I'm better off than when I started, for sure.
I think that it's really a shame that there even is, it's like an advantage just to have class mobility. And I think that if a lot of people weren't impoverished and weren't disadvantaged, that the adoption industry would be a lot smaller and there wouldn't be as many people that do this for a living. And so it's not in the adoption industry's best interest for there to be within communities support and redistribution and public housing. You know, they don't want people to have options available to them if they choose to parent their children. And so it's not wise to lean on those professionals for moral compass purposes. So I think that a lot of people get into a specific ear and it kind of is insidious. And so a lot of people don't think about aiding other people monetarily or otherwise. And that's what has really led to people being really, really rich because they're in adoption. And it's not going to change until the socioeconomic system changes, because they're working with what has been designed long before any of us got here. So it's a much deeper issue than just class and adoption. It's unbelievably difficult to unpack, but I mean, you have to start somewhere.
People kind of get, well, I didn't do it, so I'm not going to do anything about it. And so it's easy to kind of sit back. If you're not faced with those issues personally, it's easy to sit back and say, well, not my problem. And so I think that's a huge mistake, big mistake, huge. We definitely are getting somewhere. I feel like we're getting somewhere relationship-wise in this community, the way that we advocate, each one of us have advocated for equity in relationships, for, you know, not closing the door on each other and striving for healthy, open adoptions with the focus on our children. And I do see changes. I do see changes in the relationships that are being built, as at least in this community that we are in. But there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of work that needs to be done outside of adoption. It's little by little, and sometimes it's one step forward, two steps back. But I think we're all young enough that we have some hope, young and dumb enough that we have some
hope. You guys might be. I am tired.
Yeah, but you know what? Ashley, I know that you're older than me and us, but I also think that you're dumb enough to have the hope. And that's fine.
10 years later, and I am still
dumb.
10 years later, I'm still believing that we can create change.
And that's it. And I think I see, like, I listen to, like, you know, podcasts with, like, people that were part of movements 50 years ago, and they're still young, dumb, and hopeful. And that's what we need to be.
That's what I am.
50 years old, but they're young, dumb, and hopeful. And God, I hope I'm like that if I get to 80, I hope, because I think I don't want to be a crotchety old person that's like pessimistic. And
you're getting your pessimism out now in your youth so that you can be happier later.
True. It's true. I am pessimistic, but I like to think it's realism, not pessimistic. Mm-hmm. But I hope that when you see yourself as a part of this community, you don't think, if we don't get this done in my lifetime, then I give up. I think you have to see yourself as part of this community for the long haul. And the long haul means doing the work now so that the people that are going to be doing the work, and they will still be doing the work when we die, that they're not doing the same work that we're doing.
Yeah.
They have to be progressed beyond what we've done.
The next generation has to be better. And I think we're a long way from seeing this, but, you know, and I'm sure Erica will have a thought on this too, but I believe, you know, I may not see it in my lifetime, but I absolutely know that my kids that I parent and Derek and, you know, 10 years from now, when they're speaking to the effects of open adoption in their relationship, has got to be better than what we've learned from adoptees that we've been listening to. I mean, if not, then what the hell are we even doing this for?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that it's imperative to live what you are preaching and to, you know, honor your community, but also honor your triad, and don't steer away from that for any reason. I think a lot of birth mothers get judged by the way they respond to placement. And I think that a lot of, you know, coping mechanisms that aren't healthy, those make a lot of sense to respond to placing your child and deciding not to raise your child. That makes a lot of sense to me. And so if you're an adoptive parent and you feel like you can't offer more support, or you can't be there for your child's birth parent because of the way they're coping with things, don't do that. You know, don't forget that it makes sense that you would cope however way you need to cope in order to get through, and to just continue to honor your child's birth parents in a compassionate way, and not don't use your brain so much in this. Don't forget that you're dealing with a human.
I love it. So there is one question that we're asking each of our guests this season after, or like at the end of every episode. And that is, if you could change anything about adoption, what would you change?
So many things to change.
Pick one.
I know. It's hard to pick. I would say I would change the response to birth parents. I think that would definitely help in healing, and it would help the adoptees. I think that if an adoptee is growing up in a world where they're seeing everybody kind of generalize birth parents, and, you know, with the stupid movies that are out there that really do poorly depict birth parents, that's harmful. And so that's definitely something that I am eager to see transform, so that people that have been adopted can honor their story without feeling that shame of coming from whatever society has said that they come from.
Great. Yeah, I think awesome. That's a huge thing. Like, I can't even watch certain things. Like, I know Ashley, like, she's like, oh, I watched The Handmaid's Tale. And I'm like, absolutely not.
That's because I'm the kind of birth mom that's very dark and twisty in, like, my humor and my, like, I don't get triggered the same way that a lot of people do when I come to the table. That kind of stuff doesn't affect me the same way. Maybe that's just because it's so damaged that it doesn't, like, translate that this is not healthy. But I love The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, like, but I do think, too, like, the way it's portrayed, well, the response to birth moms goes beyond TV movie entertainment. It goes into your churches, and it goes into how you talk about your adoption to the people in your life, to your neighbors, to your friends and family, and how we respond to women in crisis pregnancies overall. So I definitely think it's a culture issue. And it transcends beyond Hollywood and entertainment. It is a culture deep-rooted issue.
The professionals are an easy target, and they've definitely built an industry around exploiting this, but they did that because it existed before they decided to create an industry around it. So let's not forget that there is plenty of societal and systemic issues that, yes, the adoption industry chose to capitalize on, but let's not pretend that this hasn't existed before that.
Right. And I think if I were an opportunist and wanted to make easy money, and it was, you know, 30 years ago, I probably would have gotten into adoption myself. And, you know, that it makes sense. It's good money, but it's like, that's not okay.
Who are you exploiting to get the money?
Exactly. Yeah. So I think that the work that the two of you are doing is imperative and really admirable, and I don't think that it goes unnoticed. And I mean, the next few years are going to be really exciting, I think.
Hell yeah. Okay.
Well, we love you. We're so glad that you're here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, this is awesome. So thank you guys for joining us. We'll see you next time on the Twisted Sisterhood podcast.
Bye.